Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome Craig Chiquiso, guitarist from Jefferson Starship. You've heard his work on classics like Sarah and We've Built This City. He's also an amazing songwriter and has created a successful solo career and been on an on-demand session guitarist. We'll be hearing him play live tonight and tell us why he chooses carving guitars. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We got a good one tonight. This is going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Just got back from Sweetwater in Fort Wayne. Apparently, Craig was at Sweetwater, but a different one in California.
That's
right. But yeah, I just went to the Gear Fest. That was it's a pretty amazing place. Over there, and
anything interesting or new that up to mention?
Well, I went to quite a few of the different classes they had, and I went to go see some guy with a mustache named Jeff Skunk Baxter. I don't know, might have heard of him. Anyways, that guy is retarded smart. Like he is, it's crazy. He's doing all kinds of stuff, secret stuff for the government besides playing guitar and killing it. Yeah, he was pretty interesting to watch. He went into a whole physics lesson on sound waves and how they become colors, and it was wild. Anyways, it was quite a good time.
So is he doing like a lecture circuit or something? What is he doing?
Well, I mean, he was brought in there because he was demonstrating something for Roland. It's a new, they call it a true synthesizer for guitar. So it's not like the synthesizer you think in this regards, you know, you play a chord on your guitar and you hear an orchestra. It's the kind where you can play with a regular guitar, regular magnetic pickups, and it will convert that signal into a synthesis sound similar to those old Moogs, and you can, you know, oscillate it and add all kinds of different oscillators on top of it and create some pretty funky sounds, and it's pretty revolutionary on their side. So it was pretty neat. There's no lag time. It was pretty neat.
Yeah, their pickups, they've really gotten really good at getting that lag down.
Oh, no, there's no pick. I mean, no, you can plug in the straight-up guitar. It doesn't have to be a special Roland guitar. You can take, a Fender Squire or a Gibson Epiphone with nothing special in it, plug the sucker in there, and you can get all kinds of crazy Moog effects. It's pretty wild.
Oh, okay, but does it do other stuff like the VG series? I know they made a
this whole thing is just, it's meant to just be a pedal to create those kind of original synthesizer sounds. Think something like when you hear the soundtrack for Clockwork Orange.
Oh, okay. So strictly a Moog synthesizer type of
thing. Yeah, pretty wild. It was cool to see, but I mean, hearing him talk about stuff was just mind-blowing. So,
how did you like the Sweetwater factory? I guess you took a tour of the place, right?
Well, you can walk around and check the whole place out. I mean, it's a pretty amazing little place. I mean, they have a huge slide there that my kid loved going down, but it's the place is set up quite well.
Is it a big place?
And their shipping facility is amazing. I mean, you can order something, walk back there, and it'll be ready for you.
Is it pretty big? How big is the place?
Well, it's on 100 acres, so it's pretty big.
Yeah, that's pretty huge.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, and the one other thing was crazy was there was huge rainstorms during the whole thing. And so you'd be in there looking at, you know, $3,000, $4,000, you know, Gibson, Fender guitars and amps and all that stuff. And there's just like a river of water flowing under your feet. It's pretty cool.
Well, I just want to mention tomorrow is June 16th. And a couple of weeks ago, we had Denny Tedesco, that Tommy Tedesco's son. And he had done this movie that's been taking a long, long time to be done just to get all the clearances and stuff. And we talked about it on the show. And it's coming out on the 16th, finally, on Blu-ray and DVD. The Wrecking Crew movie, the Wrecking Crew film, is coming out. And if you go on their site, www.wreckingcrewfilm.com, and mention, use the code word, the flow, you get 20% off on the DVD or the Blu-ray or the new coffee table book they have with a bunch of pictures of stuff. It's great because you can see all the cool guitars that they used back then. Those were the real ones. Those, you know, they were brand new back then, but now they're like vintage in demand. But they're going to be at Amoeba Records in Hollywood tomorrow at 6 o'clock. It'll be Denny, it'll be Don Randy, and Hal Blaine, and they'll be signing them. So if you are in that area around 6 o'clock, I recommend going down there and get it signed by all three of them. They're a part of history and very important, changed the shape of music forever. And if you can't, then just go on their website, mention, put the flow in under the when you for the discount, and you'll get 20% off. So I just thought I would mention that to everybody.
And that's flow without a W. I assume they put it in that way.
F-L-O, yeah, the flow. Well, that's the other way is just a variation. The flow, F-L-O, I think, is the original. That's just me. Anyway, let's get on with it. Let's go ahead and let's get on with the show because we got a lot to talk about. And very interesting story with Craig here. I want to welcome you, first of all, just thank you for coming down, and Dara for putting this together. It's just really a treat to have you guys here because through the years, I mean, I followed your career just listening all the songs and stuff that you did. But it's really interesting because you experience some part of the history of rock that it's you know, invaluable. I'm totally jealous because you got to see some amazing stuff, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But real quick, I want to talk about the beginning. I was reading on your website about your background, and you had been in a car accident when you were really young, and you were in recovery. And your dad said, "If you if you really work at it and recover, I'll get you a Les Paul."
That's exactly right. My dad and I were involved in a drunk driving crash where the person who hit us was drunk, and there was a fatality was involved. In fact, the guy that hit us was the one who died. Usually it's the other way around, but we woke up in the hospital, and we were in two different hospitals, and after being unconscious for 3 days, I came to with two broken arms, broken thumb, broken wrist, broken leg, broken ankle, broken foot.
Wow.
It wasn't as bad as it sounds, though. I mean, you're like 12 years old, and you wake up in the hospital, and the first thing they do is bring you ice cream.
That's cool.
And I didn't have to go to school on Monday, and I had my own tutor. I mean, my arms were all in casts and everything, and that's probably where that nurse, the naughty nurse fetish came from. But No, I joke.
That's Halloween, actually.
but yeah, it was during the... I had just gotten an acoustic guitar at that point. My mom and dad were musicians, and they played a lot around the house when I was growing up. And their music was more traditional. They were listening more to the songs of their generation. And so my dad played the saxophone and the accordion, and my mom played the organ and the piano. And after dinner, they would get together and play these great classic songs, you know, written by Bernstein and Hammerstein's and all the Steens and, you know,
yes,
all of those
yes.
great songs. And they actually read music, which scared me. You know, the old joke, how do you get a guitar player to turn down? Just put sheet music in front of them. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot from other friends and by ear. But I had only started playing the acoustic guitar because after 2 years of accordion lessons, they kind of tricked me into that. They said, "Would you like to play the accordion? Your dad plays the accordion." And I'm like 10, and I'm going, "Yeah, my dad plays it. That'd be cool." Then I get, you know, the instrument comes in a suitcase. And it was just like this boxy thing. And I didn't even know what an accordion, you know, was supposed to sound like or do. But I learned right away that I didn't like it. And then I started hearing more guitar on the radio. And I gravitated towards that. And I think my mom and dad decided they'd get me acoustic guitar, to figuring it was just a phase I was going through and that I'd grow out of it. And, you know, my dad told me as he was taking me to an accordion lesson, I was like really bummed out. And he's going, what's the problem? Music's supposed to be fun. Not if you're playing the accordion, Dad. I want to play guitar. And he said, well, if you, you know, my dad was great about this. He said, if you just, we already paid for the accordion lesson. If you just get through the one lesson, then you could play guitar if you want, you know. Mm-hmm. So mom, I think she saved up a little money from her lunch money and bought me this little $10 acoustic guitar, and I played it until my fingers bled. I never stopped. And they thought, well, wow, you must really like the guitar. Mm-hmm. And then we were in this car crash, and I woke up, and the first thing I asked for was my little acoustic guitar. And my doctor, I think, knew that it would be good for my circulation and keeping my muscles from atrophying in the casts. But I think she also knew that I loved it so much that it would be a good inspiration spiritually and for my heart and soul to have something like music, you mm-hmm, know, during mm-hmm. a frightening time. And so through my wheelchair therapy and my crutches and my corrective shoes, the guitar was my best friend. And my dad told me about Les Paul, who was in a bad car accident. He said that they actually set his arm so that he could continue to play. And Dad said, you know, it looks kind of bleak now. All your arms and legs and fingers and thumbs are in casts, and your legs in this huge cast. But if you stick with your physical therapy, I'll buy you a Les Paul guitar when you're done. So he kept his word. He bought me a Les Paul. He didn't get it to me right away. He bought me another little intermediate guitar in between, but we eventually got to the Les Paul, and it was one of those really unusual white fretless Wonder ones where it was shaped like an SG and it had the ebony neck. And
so you had the three pickup.
Yes.
The three pickup SG, the custom.
Yeah. It was a little overkill.
Do you still have it?
No, I don't. I wish I did. I've seen pictures of me playing it, though. I've got pictures of me with it, and then Hendrix played it for that same style guitar for a little while, so I was thrilled to see him play that. And so yeah, Dad kept his word, and you know, now being that I've it's been this many years since that waking up in the hospital, and the fact that my doctor encouraged me to play, I wrote a song on one string on the guitar, just on the E string, because that was the only string I can reach, you know, the way my fingers stuck out of the cast. So I played the heck out of one string, and I wrote a song on the one string, and since it was the E string and my doctor's name was Elizabeth, I called it Elizabeth's song. And it's a song she heard over and over again, whether she liked it or not. But it ended up on a Grammy nominated album of mine 30 years later. And if it wasn't for my dad and my doctor and that, you know, maybe I'd be playing accordion still.
Well, I started on accordion and I actually won a guitar.
Perfect.
In an accordion contest. And it was like an old plywood Stella. And I still have it.
It's perfect.
It's sitting in storage in a bunch of dust. But it's funny that people don't remember at that time when we were younger, that was a big deal. Accordion was a big, people thought that was like the instrument for kids to play.
Yeah. Then they give you that line. It's the only self-contained instrument that can accompany and play lead. And, you know, and you could carry it around because you can't do that with a piano. And a guitar only plays, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I bought that.
No, we eventually got the Cordovox with the organ and accordion in it.
Yep.
It was, my dad would lug that everywhere. We used to play USO shows back in the 60s. And we did all these gigs like that. And it was really funny.
I'm still waiting for someone to take the accordion and plug it through some wah-wah pedals and some fuzz tones and some Marshalls and just go all the way with it. Maybe I need to do that.
I think Weird Al does it.
Oh, does he do that? Okay.
I think he does something bizarre with the mm-hmm. accordions, but I'm not sure. But I think so. He was. But anyway, so that's interesting. You had an SG or the Les Paul custom version of that. That's a cool guitar.
It was a really cool guitar, and it makes me appreciate, too, that my dad was so supportive, because it wasn't like we were like a really wealthy family that can afford these expensive guitars. But, you know, Dad worked a lot, and I think it was a way for him back then. You know, I think from that generation, parents didn't really, you know, go camping and hug their kids as much as like we like to do now. So that was his way of being that he was such a, you know, supporting the family and working so hard. That was his way to kind of support this sort of spiritual, musical, something between the angels and the arithmetic and the science and the spirit and the music and the magic was the guitar. And Dad was really supportive of that. And, you know, when I was growing up, I had all the pictures of my heroes on the wall, like Hendrix and Clapton and Santana and Jimmy Page and everybody that, that I wanted to someday play like. And I realize now that the real heroes were my mom and dad that had the courage to have that day job and, you know, pay my bills and put the walls, you know, roof over my head and feed me while I practiced guitar. Yeah. Anything else to do. I just went to school.
Well, I think it's cool that they played together. A family that plays, jams together, stays together. I really think that's true.
Well, they did indeed. They stayed together for 50 years. And then my brother, though, I have to say, my 13 years older than me brother, who's a Vietnam-era veteran, had these great tape recorders. He was in the submarine service. And they'd go to Japan and stock up on these electronics. And he'd come home. And no, I was the only kid on my block that had a big brother with a reel-to-reel tape recorder. So when he would go on be deployed and stuff, he would actually let me use his tape recorder. And I was like, you know, just a little kid, really. And so I started learning sound on sound. And I started to learn how to tape albums. You know, Tower Records had this great plan that if you went in and bought an album and you didn't like it, you can bring it back. And so I'd ride my bicycle to Tower Records and I'd buy, like, say, a Led Zeppelin album, Led Zeppelin 1. I'd take it home, tape it on my brother's reel-to-reel, get it all set
get
up.
Get all there.
And then I'd ride my bicycle back a day later and go, hey, I didn't like this album. Can I return it? And they said, okay, well, what do you if you don't like Led Zeppelin 1, what do you want to get? Led Zeppelin 2. And so on and so on.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's cool.
So I can't really complain about anybody that's like downloading music anymore because it's I guess I did it first when I was taping it on my brother's tape machine. So
yeah. No, I sound on sound was a big deal.
Yeah.
Eventually my dad got us this old Ampex thing that was really it didn't have sound on sound, but it was a stereo recorder and I used to take that everywhere and plug it into didn't know anything about impedance matching and whatever. Sometimes it sounded okay. Sometimes I just like distorted like all hell. But then I liked that. I'd plug the guitar and distort it.
Me
purpose.
Too. Hey, if you turn this all the way up, it kind of gets all distorted and fuzzy. And you could play Satisfaction on it.
Yeah. It had that sound.
It had that sound.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and play a clip. This is one of the songs that you wrote for the Jefferson Starship. And I edited some. Well, it's the beginning part because there's a bunch of different guitars. You're doing stuff, and let's get a little bit into the equipment. This is the hit "Find Your Way Back." Now, in that opening there, in that first verse, you've done like a bunch of a zillion different things in there. Let's just go break it down a little bit. I know you're starting with an acoustic 12-string in there.
Correct.
And what were you using?
I was using a Guild 12-string. They're big. God, what is that model called? It's a gorgeous, giant acoustic 12-string that Paul Kantner actually turned me on to. Because okay. I had hooked him up with some other guitars, and he actually turned me on to that 12-string that I still have. And we went into the studio, recorded it to a click track, because the acoustic nature of that intro, you know, we wanted it to be recorded really clean, so we put the click track in the headphones, and then I went in and recorded three tracks. So it's mixed in left and right, and then a guitar in the center. And what that does for me, which I love, is it puts your head in and your brain and your ears in the middle of the guitar. You hear the strings right. from the left and the right and the top, and I just love that illusion that that kind of multi-tracking creates. You know,
it's really full. And then at the very end, we'll get into the middle part with the electric guitars, but at the very end, mm-hmm. there's a 12-string thing happening, but it's a little different sound. Is that electric 12-string?
Well, the part that right before you fade it out in between the chorus and the next verse, that part that goes...
Yeah, go ahead. You're on.
That part there is a Strat and a single coil with a little bit of a boost on it to give it some bite and some presence. But if you listen carefully, the 12-string is still in there because the 12-string comes back in the second verse, and that electric takes over for one of the acoustic 12-strings.
Okay, because that Strat gives mm-hmm. you that kind of hollow,
yes.
kind of a honk to it. I don't yep. know how to describe it.
That's right. Yeah.
But it gets that tone. That's a great sound.
What I like about that particular passage, though, is that in the beginning when we recorded the whole song on acoustic guitar, because the acoustic guitar shows up throughout the song, but it's really noticeable in the beginning, and then the Strat comes in and adds another layer along with the acoustic guitar. But during that break, before the band comes in the second time after that first chorus, if you listen really carefully, you can hear two distinct clicks in between some of the phrasing because it goes click, click. So if you listen to the record, there's those two clicks. That's the click track bleeding from the headphones
oh,
into
wow.
all the mics.
Oh, wow.
But live, whenever we play that, Ainsley Dunbar he'd count the band in, like clicking his drumsticks. So it was just this illusion. Everybody thought, oh, that must be Ainsley in the studio clicking the sticks, but it was actually the click track.
Now, what were you using? Okay, then you have like the power chord. You mm-hmm. know, after the opening 12-string, you have the power chords, and then you do the double leads.
Yes.
So what were you using there?
By then, you know, I was really getting into the carbon guitar, so I'm sure I was using carbons. I don't think we were doing the V220 quite yet, but the idea was to create sort of a Les Paul through a Marshall sound, and I think we used I don't think we used Pauls on that. We used carbons, and then if I'm not mistaken, I had some carbon 4x12 cabinets and this great tube head they made that was just so reliable and unbelievably clean power, but it was a little overkill, we thought, for this recording session. So we ended up using a little amp with a 12-inch speaker. I think it was one of the first Boogie Mark IIs for that tone. And later I started using the carbons live, you know, because they were louder and bigger and they filled it out on stage. But in the studio, it's kind of interesting how sometimes a smaller amp
yeah.
and a less distorted sound can actually sound bigger when it's recorded.
Yeah.
And I have my own theory about that. I think that when you record a guitar without too much distortion, but just enough that it's got an edge and a bite, and you have a great lick, then everybody who hears it on the radio is going to turn it up. And then when they turn it up, their radio distorts.
No, that's true.
So if your guitar is too distorted already, then it's going to get worse. But when your guitar has just enough distortion to sound bitey,
right.
but then when you turn it up, that's the sound I really like.
Well, it's interesting. Like,
second
and
layer.
Like one of you had mentioned one of your influences, Hendrix. If you remember in Band of Gypsies, a lot of it, what he's doing when he's not using the fuzz face,
mm-hmm.
his amp is loud, but it's not that dirty, but mm-mm. it's enough where the Strat will hold the tone and it'll start feedbacking.
Yep.
But it's basically a nice, a cleaner sustain. It has a nice bloom to it. It's a little bit of dirt, but it's, you know, that sound. And I remember a lot of players would get that out of a twin cranked.
That's right.
And it's clean,
mm-hmm.
but if you dig into it, it gets a little grit to it.
Yeah, it starts to bite a little
yeah.
bit. But when you back off, it's still got that clean, fundamental note is still there. So the tone is a little more established without all that distortion. And I, as a guitar player, I originally just really like distortion, and I would overdo it. But when I started working with producers like Ron Nevison, who did Find Your Way Back, and another song I wrote with the band Jane, which really featured a lot of guitar in there, he had produced, he had worked with Zeppelin and The Who and UFO and produced us. He did Heart as well. But he was a real guitar-oriented producer, and so he was way into double tracking the guitars, and, mm-hmm. and that's where I first learned that idea of sometimes you can record this stuff at a lower volume and without all that as much distortion as I thought I liked, but it would actually sound better.
Yeah, I found bigger. In some of the sessions that I did, I found that if you instead of putting one acoustic guitar and bringing the fader up to bring it in, if I double tracked it, put it wide left, wide right, and you didn't have to turn it up as much, but you would still hear it.
Exactly.
So it didn't get in the way.
No, and it creates that really nice nice stereo framework right. that's on the left and the right, and it right. leaves a place in the middle for the voices and stuff.
Too. And the now that lead that we're doing the double leads in Find Your Way Back, mm-hmm. it sounds kind of single coil. It has a lot of bite to it that mm-hmm. didn't. That would be the Carvin. The Carvin, because that didn't sound like a humbucker.
No, it would be Carvin, and they had coil tap switches going on back then, too. So we were messing around with all sorts of tones and trying things. And I know sometimes we would just record the parts a few times with different guitars and then just listen back in the studio and just see if one of them sounded better for that particular song and stuff. But the one of the things about that tone that I liked is I ended up doing a lot of my song ideas at home on a home studio. Mm-hmm. Because that way I felt that if I had an idea, I could just throw it down on tape and sort of give an idea of what I thought the drums and bass and keyboards should sound like. Like Jane, I pretty much wrote all those parts, you know. But before that, the band kind of had this anarchistic approach, as everybody just plays what they want. And that worked out great, too, because we had some really big mm-hmm. hits with Miracles and stuff. And I liked that sort of free-for-all. But a little bit later, when I started building my own studio, I found that I could sometimes save some time by putting my ideas down on tape and then bringing that demo to the band and say, this is kind of what I'm thinking. What do you guys think? And what would you add to it? Mm-hmm. So when I made the demo for Find Your Way Back, I was using these MXR little stomp boxes and just plugging through a little, a little four-track tape recorder. And we liked the tone so much that, you know, I went back home and grabbed those boxes and plugged them direct into the board to get that sound. And what I liked about those solos is one of the harmonies is a stereo chorus, so you hear it coming from the left and the right, and the other harmony is right up the center. And what happens, there's a bloom there. There's a left and right thing that happens, and it's organic, and it kind of gives you this
dimension. It kind of moves mm-hmm. in its own way.
Yeah. Yeah. It stays centered, but you hear these left and right feelings coming yeah. in and out. And I just love that. That rich sound. And I Mike Klink was our second engineer or first engineer on that with Ron Nevison, who later went on to produce Guns N' Roses and mm-hmm. stuff. So I was in heaven as a guitar player with these two producers and engineer guys that mm-hmm. could really, you know, channel what I was trying to get across. So we had a lot of fun in the studio.
Well, that's cool because they let you experiment a little bit on that.
Yeah.
Now tell us how you got involved with Carvin and the little bit of your background on that, how that all came together.
Well, I was really influenced to start going towards the older guitars really early. I started buying, after my first Starship tour, I wasn't even 21 yet, I bought a 57 Gold Top. and then I bought a 59 Sunburst. And this was a long time ago. I mean, they were expensive then, but nowhere like what they are now. Yeah. But I
you still have them, please tell me.
Oh,
still
man, you know, we're getting to that. You got a Kleenex here? I'm going to get
this guy. It's very painful what he's going to bring up. But go ahead.
Well, so I liked, I was kind of the younger, I was on the younger side for a lot of the musicians that I was hanging with. And I think that was a benefit because the older guys were always like giving me pointers and stuff, you know, which I was always grateful for, you know. And I remember Jorma Kaukonen's brother, Peter Kaukonen, who was a fabulous guitar player. He actually played bass on the first Jefferson Starship tour, but he would do a guitar song during the night. And I just thought he was one of the best guitar players I've ever seen in my life. But he turned me on to the Fender Bassman concept of tone, which was pretty interesting. It's just like turn all the knobs up to 10 and the bass all the way to 0 and then pull the knobs off and just leave it like that. And it was amazing because it was like that idea we were talking about where it's enough tube sound and clean and power, but when you start turning them all up at that level, there's a little bit of distortion in there, but yet it's still really clean. And you roll that bass off and that treble, you turn it up louder, it's starting to add its own bass anyway, so you don't need the bass
right.
tone.
Well, it protects your speaker too.
Yeah, exactly right. And so that kind of idea of that bright yet slightly distorted tone really hung with me, and that was the tone I used like for the first Dragonfly album and songs like Ride the Tiger and for the first four Jefferson Starship albums. I used the 59 Sunburst, a couple of 57 Gold Tops. I had a 59 dot inlay ES-335, a 57 Strat with a maple neck. I'm starting to cry. But those were, I would take them on the road. I would record them in the studio and I'd take them on the road. So we did a tour in Europe where Grace got ill and half the band was at this big festival in Lorelei, Germany, and the other half was still at the hotel. And when they announced that we couldn't perform without Grace, there was a riot. and all the equipment got destroyed. The stage got burnt down. It made all the network news, three, CBS, ABC, NBC, you know, Jefferson Starship in Germany loses their equipment and there's a riot. And we could actually see the flames from the mountain.
They burned the stage, Scott.
They did indeed.
They burned everything.
We went back and saw the little metal corners of the basements. I had like four basement cabins and four heads that would be stacked up on stage. All that was left was the little metal corners and area. You could see a little bit of the charred Tolex in the wood. It was just heartbreaking. And we never did see the guitars. I mean, I never saw anything left. I never saw any pieces, but there was nothing left. The stage, it looked like
a bomb
hit. I
read that somebody had taken some of the guitars and put them off stage, but somebody grabbed them and took off with them.
Well, we weren't ever really totally sure about that, but as time has gone on, I think that's true, because Pete Sears got one of his basses back just within a year or two ago, and that he hadn't seen it in 35 years. In fact, that lineup of the band, the first hit lineup with all the Miracles and those four albums we did with Red Octopus, Dragonfly, Spitfire, Earth, that lineup has not played again since 1978 after that riot, because when Grace couldn't do the show, we did one more show with her after the riot in Berlin or something, and she was really eccentric that night. There's, if you Google it, it's pretty entertaining. But then after that, we played Knepworth without her, 100,000 people. We played with Genesis and Tom Petty and the Atlanta Rhythm Section, and it was just some great bands, but we did it without Grace. And we thought, well, we could do this, and we decided to go back to San Francisco, and then a lot of other tragedies happened. Our drummer got in a bad car accident, and Marty never came to rehearsal. But in that dark time, it sort of opened the door, a little crack of the door for some light to come through, and we ended up getting Ainsley Dunbar on drums, Mickey Thomas on vocals. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was looking for new guitars. And I didn't want to necessarily start replacing my vintage guitars with more vintage guitars that are hard to replace. So I started looking around at the NAMM shows and all for what would be good. And so mm-hmm. I started asking my older guitar player friends, like, okay, if I'm not going to go vintage, what's out there? And I was hearing about Carbon from people like John Cipollina before that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Those guitars had been known by a lot of musicians because they were handmade in California. And the Carbon Company was started by the dad at the same time Fender was started in the 40s. And they've been making guitars ever since. And the brothers started, you know, continued the legacy. I think Carbon is like a couple of letters from each of the sons' names. Mm-hmm. And so one thing led to another. I started playing BC Rich for a while, which I liked. Felt a little bit fragile to me on stage because they're really thin, but I like the neck through body design. I was looking for something like that, like those Les Pauls had. So when I went to Carbon and saw they were already making guitars like that, we started talking. I spoke to the owner, Mark Kiesel, who's been a dear friend ever since. I mean, I think we're lifelong buddies now after all these years. But you know, I said, how about making something that's even more like a Les Paul with like a thicker body with this sort of mahogany or make the whole body out of maple, make it solid, put a larger neck like a Les Paul. And what we would do a lot to our guitars, or it just sounds sacrilegious now to the vintage guitars, but we would refret them with bigger frets, say, like that fretless Wonder SG Paul I had really flat frets. So it was hard to get any bite when you stretch strings. You couldn't, because your finger would hit the fretboard because the frets were so low before you can get your finger under the string to push it up. So the higher frets.
The higher crown ones. Crowns. So you got like your 335. Yep. I have it a fretless Wonder black Les Paul single cutaway.
Same one, yeah.
And I took it to Valdez and he shaved the neck and he cleaned it all up and put new frets and it plays great.
Yep, that's the difference. I mean, that fretless Wonder was supposed to be the real low action, real fast, but you couldn't really do a lot of the blues techniques.
No, you couldn't bend, but
no.
It was good for what Les was doing.
Exactly.
A lot of that quick fender or anything, but you couldn't do any bending.
No.
I agree.
So I talked to Carbon about that. I said, you know, we take the guitars anyway and a lot of times we'll be changing the nut. You know, at that time, Alembic was making some great guitars for the Grateful Dead in the Bay Area, and so I was watching how their designs were coming around, and they would put brass nuts in the neck, and then they would put a more massive tailpiece in. The Badass Bridges were pretty popular back in
those
tailpieces.
Remember those.
And then the tuners, you know, we would replace those with Grovers or Schallers or something a little more durable on the road. So just those couple of basic little mods was all that really needed to be done. Sometimes the plastic jack at the bottom would break, so we were putting metal ones in there. So when I talked to Carbon about making, you know, some new guitars, we decided that it would be a good idea to make the guitar right off the shelf with all that stuff in it. So we did the V220, which was all their design. I was just there, you know, innocent bystander, throwing some ideas around. But when that guitar came out, it was just everything I was looking for. And it replaced my Les Pauls and my Strats because it had this great single coil, double coil tap switch, the two humbuckers, you know, that you could go to the single coil sound. You know, I had a few made with a Kaler back then and then a Floyd Rose. And it was like the all-purpose guitar. And we would joke, even to this day, we say, you know, when we would get a guitar from Carbon, we would open the case and it would always be in tune right out of the case. We would just laugh. Like, somebody's in charge of tuning the guitars before they even send them. Because when you get it, you know, and you open the case, it's brand new, it's in tune. But
hey, Craig?
Yes.
On that coil tap, is it the kind where it would just cut out one of the, ground out one of the coils for the humbucker? Or would it actually keep and retain the same volume level as your humbucker?
I always thought that the single coils dropped a little in volume, so I'm not sure how their wiring worked. That's a little more of a technical question than I'm able to answer. We might have to call Carbon on that one. Because, you know, like you said, there's different versions. It was definitely passive electronics, though. There wasn't a battery in there.
Yeah.
And
but I think back then they just disconnected the coil. I don't think they got as sophisticated at that time.
It seems to me that it was
probably
pretty
simple. And
he was
one of the first that split.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, B.C. Rich had started doing it, too, and because that's when DiMarzios just came out around that time,
yep.
too.
Yeah.
And they were you could get them wired like that. The Gibson ones, they had a custom tap from it to get them. You know, if you were using a regular humbucker or something, you had to mod it to get the tap.
Right, right. And that reminds me of the Strats that had the three-position switches, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then they eventually started making the five-position switch because so many people were trying to find that little sweet spot in between.
Right,
So. I love how the musical instruments evolve. I mean, I don't think that some of the guys that designed the original guitars thought they'd end up being used the way they were used. I mean, did Les Paul have any idea that Jimmy Page was going to play that thing like that, or Dwayne Allman? And when they made these amps, did anybody think they were just going to always play them on 10 and that Marshall was going to add that
That's true.
Sound? It's great how people take that and turn it into their own
Well, it's interesting that design of the, especially the PAF mm-hmm. style humbucker and the single coils that Fender made from the 50s are still the you know, everybody, that's what's in demand. And no matter what the new technology is, they're trying to get that, they're trying to mimic what was very old. It worked, you know?
Well, again, I just designed a pedal board for 2015 that's really based on a pedal board I designed in 1975. And it's all those MXR devices and the original Wah-Wah pedal design and the Phase 90. Back then, there were 9-volt batteries. And they didn't have lights on because you couldn't tell if it was on. So we made one. We put it on a board. We wired it so you could go AC into it. Did that to replace batteries. And we put little LEDs in it. So when it was on, the LED came on. Now they make them that way off the shelf. But it's still the old electronics. It's the old circuitry with even down to the same little boxes. The box itself is the same that it was 40 years ago. And Jimmy Dunlop has been doing those for a while. And it's like you said, what's old is new again.
Yeah.
And everybody's looking for that older sound, those old older pickup sounds, the PAFs, all that, the 90s, all those things are coming back. You know,
well, when you were touring, maybe it would be after the Starship, did you go to a rack system like some of the guitar players like Lukather, they went to the rack, but now they're going back to the pedal boards with the pedals.
Yep.
It seemed like it went to this like a real elaborate system, and then now it's going back to the older. Did you find yourself doing, did you use
exactly.
rack stuff?
That's exactly what I did. There was a great, oh man, why can't I remember his name? There was a great rack designer here in LA.
Bob Bradshaw.
That's
Bradshaw.
Right. Thank you, Bob Bradshaw.
We had
of course. And, you know, he was making racks for everybody. Larry Carlton, I know Pink Floyd had him. David Gilmour is one of my favorite guitar players, largely because of his tone. And his rack, well, his phrasing, of course, but his rack had some great devices in it. And, I gravitated right towards the Bradshaw racks. I had all the heads in a couple of cabinets. I was like, Craig's here. There's a couple of refrigerators out there with gear.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually did a gig with Starship one time where they couldn't fit my rack through the door of the auditorium or wherever.
Oh,
we
wow.
were. So the rack was just outside with all these cables coming through the door. That only happened once. But it was so big that unless you are touring on a mega tour with semi-trucks and everything, it gets a little bit prohibitive. So the rack that you could just carry around now makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, well, Bradshaw had told us when he was on the show that the demand now is to keep it under 70 pounds. You can't, that's one of the requirements now for these guys building their pedal boards. And he's doing it all on the pedal board now. The racks are dying out.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, he's the genius to do it. I mean, he's always a step ahead. When we had his racks, that was the Cadillac of guitar tone. And so if anybody's going to design the next generation, it's going to be someone
Bob. He was the big guy here, and I think in England was Pete Cornish. And Cornish took the guts out and put it in a pedal board with a pedal with the LED, but he basically had all the guts in the pedal. He just took it out of the case.
Right.
But he would shield it and do all that stuff. And he was another, he was on the, in England, all of those guys where you'd see Cornish pedals all the time. They had these like big, heavy duty foot switches. I mean, I never saw, they must be like old military ones.
I was going to say, like Russian missile launching switches.
Yeah, they were huge. I mean, you could, they were literally meant to be stomped with a, you know, a good boot or something like
As
that.
As they should be. I mean, that stuff on the road gets kicked around and stomped on all the time. So you want something that can hold up under pressure like that.
Now, you were using, when you were using the rack and stuff, what you've gone through different amps. What happened after the tragedy of all the Fenders gone, did you go back to Fenders, or did you? I know now you're using carbon, but were you know? Did you? I've seen pictures of you at Marshalls.
Yeah, I mean, I still use. There's just classic designs that'll always be great. Your Marshalls, your Fenders, your Strats, your Les Pauls. But I also found that with carbon, they were making amps that were doing all those things. They were here in California. It was really reliable. You know, they really took a lot of care in their quality control, you know, and so that meant a lot to me to be able to rely on a gear that isn't going to break or it's always going to be consistent. I had some problems with that, even with a signature model guitar that I did with another company that wasn't carbon. I noticed that if I went into a music store and saw one on the wall and pulled it down, it wasn't exactly the same as what I designed or, you know, what I was hoping would be out there. Carbon, I didn't have to worry about that. Everything they did was like spot on perfect. So as far as amps, I went from doing the Fender basement thing and had great fun with that, but I never really had to think that much about my effects. I was just using the basics, you know, the Phase 90, and had a lot of fun with that. But I have to give a lot of credit for all the producers who pulled those studio effects out and added it to the recording sessions. And Nevison and Mike Klink did that too. They would have all the racks in the studio. So I was kind of spoiled where I would just walk in and look. I would know the song. I would know what to play. But I wouldn't necessarily know all the studio tricks. But when the Bradshaw rack came out, all of a sudden the guitar players were almost forced to become engineers and really experienced with all those racks that used to be in the studio are now in the guitar players' hands. And then I think producers decided, well, you got the stuff. You do it. You know, you make it work. And then when you walked into the session, you better have two stereo cords out that you could just give them and dial in
just,
the sounds.
They would just tap right, right out, line in.
Which was a little intimidating for me because I was used to just going in and playing and have Ron or Mike come in and move the microphone around and then add their effects. I really didn't know exactly what they were doing sometimes except they'd make the guitar better. And then all of a sudden it was like the producers were going, no, you do that. You're the guitar player. So that was kind of a learning curve for me. But I'm glad, though, that it's kind of coming back full circle to the stomp boxes.
Well, let me play a clip here. I'm going to play, it's from your new album, or your latest album that you did, Fire Red Moon, and it's Crossroads. It's your version of Crossroads, but it's interesting because it shows your influence. We'll talk a little bit about the guitar there and get a little more into your influences. This is Crossroads. Now, I just want to mention that some of these clips that I'm playing, I pulled out the guitar parts because we're talking about guitar, but on this album, there's a lot of singing. You do a lot of singing on the album.
Well, I have singers on the album. I'm not doing a lot.
Oh, that's not, I thought it was you.
No, not me.
That sounds great.
Thank you.
That's really cool.
Yeah, thanks.
But anyway, now, what were you using there?
Well, my idea for that crossroads was to sort of – I love Billy Gibbons' tone, and I'd read a lot about how he used certain techniques. And one of the techniques I heard he use was to take an old original Rockman and play it through a thing that they made, a little amp cabin. I think I read about that in Guitar Player magazine. And so I tried that, and we used that kind of approach. So I got the tone I wanted, as if ZZ Top was going to do Crossroads, but as if Billy had learned every – lick note for note that Clapton played. Because when I heard Crossroads the first time, I thought Cream did it. I thought they wrote it. And to me, as much of the song was the way Eric played as it was the lyrics and the chord changes. So I wanted to be true to his phrasing, because to me that was part of the songwriting. So if I'm going to do Crossroads, I mean, I want to add something to myself, but I really wanted to honor his phrasing. And I did the same thing on that album with a another song that I first heard on Cream's album, Born Under a Bad Sign.
Bad Sign, yes.
So when the premier blues label on the planet, Blind Pig Records, asked me if I wanted to do a blues record, I was a little intimidated by that, because I said, look, I'm not one of those old blues guys from the 1920s. I'm not Robert Johnson. And I'm not, you know. And they said, well, we kind of know that. I go, but my blues, my traditional blues that you guys are so known for, because I have all their albums, is more... couple of generations later, I learned it from the English, who learned it from us. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's truly an American art form. So my idea of a classic blues album was going to be drawing from the Creams and the Hendrixes, and not so much the Robert Johnsons. And they said, great, do it that way. So we did a version of Born Under a Bad Sign that I tried to duplicate the phrasing of Jack Bruce's voice on a clean guitar, and using his phrasing that he used with his lyrics, mm-hmm. and then using the electric guitar tone to, again... be true to Clapton's phrasing. So it's an instrumental version of Born Under a Bad Sign.
And let me play that right now, since you just mentioned it. It's perfect timing. Phrasing's impeccable. You really do nail it.
Well, I have to say, it's Jack Bruce's phrasing. That's
But you got it down on both of the songs. And
thanks.
I like that clean, kind of funky little thing you're doing there. It's really, and it, the sustain of the guitar. It's just, you're holding it, and it just stays there. It's very, very, very good.
You could really hear the difference between the single coils and the clean sounds and the electric.
But it's kind of like, it's similar to like an out of phase type of
exactly.
tone.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's, I think that it's just, I love that sustain. It just holds. You can tell you got plenty of leeway there. It's just like, it's just sitting there, and it's not stopping until you change the note. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're almost out of time, so I want to mention, too, the fact that you've done a lot of stuff on acoustic guitar, and we haven't had time to really demo the mm-hmm. Carvin guitars, but you have an acoustic one right there.
Yeah.
The acoustic, which is your signature model.
Yes, it is.
And I wanted to talk – one of the songs, you did a song called Just One World, which I think is kind of cool because it's up in space right now on the NASA's ARC project. It's part of that. There was a recording that they left, and it's floating around up there.
Yep.
And I think that's very cool. But I'm going to play something totally different that's from that album, and it was a Grammy-nominated album, which I think is very cool. This is called it's a clip from The Grey Wolf Hunts Again, because it shows another aspect of you. I mean, we've heard, and we're going to hear on the out, we're going to hear your Hendrix influence. But this thing is, it's a funk type of feel, even though it's on an acoustic guitar. And it just shows the versatility of what you, you know, the different styles and stuff that you have learned and you, that you can play. And I think that's important. So I'm going to play this. This is the, it's called The Gray Wolf Hunts Again. This is very cool. That's very hip, but I like the thing that the fact that you're doing it with that. Was that all acoustic, or were there some electric guitars in there?
Acoustic. That was all acoustic.
That is amazing.
Yeah, 'cause
you're getting some pop and snap and funk.
Thanks.
And you know, having done R&B sessions, that you got that feel. That's just so cool.
Well, I got to plug a couple of guitar players that I know. If you think that's good, you got to hear this. These two guys up in Oregon in a band called the Fret Drifters that take that to the next level.
Oh wow!
Oh boy, yeah. There's some guys for your show sometime.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, you'll have to turn me on to those guys.
Hey, Craig.
Hey,
before we go, can you tell us a little bit about that guitar? Because it kind of looks like it's not only acoustic, but it sounds, from what you were doing earlier, you can actually almost make it sound electric.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that, particularly the one you're playing?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. Is that Scott in there? Are we talking?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Hey, buddy.
He's over there.
Where's that voice coming from? Yeah, this is the Carbon Craig Chiquiso signature model that originally when I recorded my first solo albums on acoustic guitar, they were all on reel-to-reel. And I was also lucky to have a great keyboard player and songwriter, Ozzy Allers, who was a keyboard player for Jerry Garcia and his live band and stuff. So my first acoustic records were all done with him on keys, and we really wanted to make it an acoustic-sounding record. So I was using an acoustic guitar that I had picked up from a rep at Washburn, who handed me this acoustic guitar that they were thinking of making, and then he died a week later. It was like so weird and spooky and voodoo. So I had this acoustic guitar, kind of a one-of-a-kind prototype, and I played my first couple albums with it, and then when I took it on tour, it was really temperamental because it was so live, being acoustic. It would feed back, especially if I'm using compression, delay, stereo delays, and gain. So I would stuff it with T-shirts. I would take these big, heavy-duty Harley T-shirts and spin them up and you know, like twist them like intestines and stuff them in the guitar to deaden it but still get the piezo pickup sound from the bridge. But it would keep it from feeding back. But it would also make it weigh like twice what a Les Paul weighs because you got like 20 T-shirts in there.
Yeah,
you
that's
know?
A big box.
I mean, it would be like you'd go to pick the guitar case up and you'd grab it and the handle would come off the case because it was so heavy. It was like, well, I got a handle. And the case is still sitting in there. So I started talking to Carbon about this, and they said, well, let's design something that still has that acoustic sound but maybe won't be so temperamental. So we came up with this model, which is a slightly thinner body, but it's still chambered and has an acoustic sound, but it's not the kind of guitar you could really play around the campfire, but you could take it camping and still hear it. But it's clean and has an acoustic sound, but it won't feed back as much when you're playing with a full band.
So that's basically for you live. You wouldn't mic that or anything. It doesn't have enough tone to...
No, I wouldn't think you would mic it, but it's such a nice little guitar to play.
Now, does that just have the piezo, or does it have another pickup?
This one just has the piezo, but Carbon does make them with the piezo and all the coil tapped humbuckings and blade pickups, too. So you could have a guitar like that, but it's more solid body. It's not like mine. Mine actually has the little sound hole in it and such, so... The one I made with Carbon, though, I was really proud of for a while because they asked me what I did to their guitar to make it sound the way it did on the albums. And I said, well, I put bigger frets on it. I shielded it so because they hummed a little bit. You know, a lot of guitars do that anyway. And I shielded it and put different tuning pegs on it and a different bridge. And so they wanted to make a Craig Chiquiso model. And I said, great, you know, just make it the way I made it based on this design from this mysterious guitar that I got from your rep who died a week later. You know, make it like that. It was a beautiful guitar. It was like a little violin, yeah. The way it was all curved and stuff. So, but I also said, you have to, if it's possible, to plant a tree for every guitar you make. So inside that, those guitars, there's a little sticker that says a tree is planted for every Craig Chiquiso model, which I'm the most proud of. I think my son will be walking through a forest with his grandson or with his son, and he'll say, hey, the reason these trees are here is because your granddad played some guitar. And they may not even know what I sounded like, but at least they can enjoy the trees at that point.
Yeah.
But that after that, though, that production model started to get shortcutted a little bit somewhere along the line because I would go into music stores and see my guitar on the wall and pick it up, and it wasn't the same guitar anymore. It was kind of like a, you know, a little bit lesser quality or something. So that was a more incentive for me to move towards the Carbon again. I was in love with them from the beginning with all their electrics, but when I did the acoustic albums, they weren't making those yet. Acoustics, so that's how we got those.
No, it works really well, and the sound of that thing, it's very consistent, and the neck is very playable. I've played them before. They're very, very nice. Well, we're out of time. Real quick, in 20 seconds, yeah. Hendrix, Sacramento.
I was an art student in Sacramento, and we were invited to paint the backdrop. And we did, and there's this great big American flag behind Hendrix that I painted that you see pictures of him in front of. And as art students, we were in heaven, but at the last minute, they didn't have enough guys to move gear, so we got deputized to be crew. So I could say I was a roadie for Jimi Hendrix for a day, because I really did move his gear around and painted that backdrop. So when I see that picture of Jimmy with the flag in the back, that was Craig at 14 years old. Yeah, hadn't
all right, Craig. Yet. Fuzz and Wah, which order were they in?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Now that's a good memory question. I would go Fuzz first and Wah. That's how I would go. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Fuzz first and then the Wah.
Yeah.
And how did it sound?
That sounded great to me. That's how my new rack is set up.
Start giving away Jimi Hendrix's fuzz pieces.
But he actually thought about it for a minute.
Well, almost.
Almost.
It was that close. Well, listen, we didn't even get it. I wish I had more time to talk about, because we were a lot of the stuff that you've been doing acoustically, besides this last album, Fire and Light, and all sorts of cool stuff there. There's some great pictures of all through the years, all his gear. You'll see him with his Les Paul. You'll see him with all these different guitars. And these guitars are great. Check out these Carbon guitars. They're very well made. And we didn't even get a chance to play the electric one, but it's a beautiful guitar. We'll take some pictures of that. I'm going to leave everybody with the title cut of the last album, Fire Red Moon, which is kind of like a Hendrix groove. You're just kind of just going off.
Well, that lyric, that's a line from a lyric of Voodoo Child. The night I was born, the moon turned to fire red, Lord. So
it's
definitely Hendrix influence. Yeah.
So it's very, very cool. And thanks again, and Dara, thank you so much for getting Craig. This is really a treat, and we have way more gear to talk about. We just touched the surface of all this stuff. So I'm going to leave you guys with that. Scott, have a great week.
Yep. And hey, everyone, don't forget to check out Dara's book, the Guitar Player book, with her dad, Jim.
Yes, he'll be on next week, and we will be talking about that book. I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be a lot of fun. So here is Fire Red Moon, a little Hendrix type of groove to make your night. Good night, everybody. Thank you very much.